Welcome to the 18th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chan.
Welcome to the podcast with all the flair of an Alistair Cook 294, but none of the professionalism.
And as we sit here in this brave new world, England now number one, we're recording on the day after the test at Edgbaston finished. Alistair Cook, really the bedrock of the whole thing, wasn't he?
It was odd that he first, I mean, the strangest thing perhaps was his look of disappointment coming off the pitch.
Yeah. There was a wonderful quote actually, which he said cricket's probably the only game where you can do something so successful as scoring 294 and yet still be disappointed.
And it was also, odd that he had to fight off criticism from Geoffrey Boycott the day after, of scoring this extraordinary innings. Yep. But it's not been the series that any of us predicted. I mean, just to remind you, you predicted a 1-0 England win. I predicted a draw.
I laughed at you for saying that as many as two tests would be won. I thought they'd all be draws.
Right. We were all thinking, like everyone, I think, a very close series, big scores from the bat. I mean, the obvious question to ask is, where has it all gone wrong for this India side?
What?
The ex-world number one.
The ex-world number one, and we won't say that too many times, but India, the number two test side in the world, they seem to have had a startling lack of ability to really adapt to English conditions, and partly I think that's because they showed a certain amount of arrogance in coming to England and saying we only need one game in which to adapt to English conditions. What has sort of startled me a little bit is that they have been, I mean, right from the word go, really, they've been failing in this series in every department.
Going back to sort of this idea of the warm-up game, I mean, you're sort of failing from the word go. I mean, they failed horribly, didn't they, down at Taunton in Somerset. I mean, it's interesting because more and more test sides seem to be not really concerning themselves with these warm-up games. And the interesting thing was that India just didn't seem to apply themselves in that game. No. They treated it as an inconvenience.
Whereas when England won the Ashes down under in the winter, they were there for something ridiculous like 2 months before. They took a huge squad down there for 2 months, made sure that every single person who might conceivably have played in the Ashes was used to Australian conditions.
And England won those warm-up games as well. They treated them seriously and they went to win those games.
It was sort of a part of the whole tour. But as you say, for India, it was sort of seen as being an obstruction before the whole thing started. But what sort of surprised me is the fact that yes, they've got this sort of stellar batting lineup, but they don't seem to have even thought about making any changes with it, despite the fact that many of their players are hideously out of form. And this might be a completely ridiculous thing for me to say, but with Tendulkar so completely out of form, with Rayner batting so badly, for instance, why they haven't made any changes yet? And they've been, you know, they've lost three times. They haven't scored more than 300, and yet they haven't made any changes to their batting.
I mean, perhaps part of it just seems
apart from the injury ones with Gambia.
They perhaps don't feel that they have. Maybe they don't feel that they have the backup. I mean, I kind of feel like agreeing with you. It's really been with the bat that the surprise has been. I mean, I think if you'd said to anyone that India would have to play most of this series without Zahir Khan, they'd have probably said, yeah, they are going to struggle. I mean, I think we knew that their bowling attack was reliant on him.
Exactly.
Perhaps we didn't know quite that it was quite this bad. But, yeah, with the batsmen, it's been interesting to the extent that you feel that we are dealing with a list of world-class batsmen that's rarely going to be repeated. I mean, you've got such a list of names. But they've just been found out, I think, in these conditions. Some of these players who've scored runs in lots of parts of the world have just really seemed to struggle. And you just feel like there's been a lack of application, and whether it's been a lack of a warm-up or just a lack of form, it's been very strange to see these great names sort of struggling.
And it seems that there have been two key examples of this, one of which is Tendulkar's dismissal in the first innings at Edgbaston, where he just chased a wide one completely needlessly and sent it to second slip. The other one, of course, has been the infamous King Pair that happened in the last test, which I just don't understand how Sehwag was playing there.
There's been some sympathy for Sehwag in that he's come in with the shoulder injury, he's had next to no practice, he batted very little in that warm-up game at Northampton. All the same, I can't help feeling that it was that dismissal in the second innings where your side is 480 behind. It desperately needs you, its real talisman, to do something.
But that's the way he plays, people will say.
Well, and that's the issue. I think it's often been said actually about Kevin Peterson, you know, that when he throws his wicket away, that that's just the way he plays. But Peterson's an example of a player who, yes, is sort of inclined to attack, but he's adapted. We saw that earlier in the season. He knocked down and made 200.
And he's now able to read match situations. And Sehwag, frankly, did not read the match situation. He needed, his team needed him to stay there and to bat out time, just to occupy the crease, however ugly it is. India didn't need runs. They just needed to stay at the crease for as long as they humanly could.
And I can accept that perhaps Sehwag felt the best way he could contribute was to maybe try and crash a quick 100, try and change the momentum of the game. And that is the kind of player he is. But that being said, he desperately needed to show some leadership to the side. He desperately needed, and you just feel like he's too good a player to have thrown his wicket away in that way. Yeah, and I think, frankly, even as English sportsmen, we were English supporters, we were disappointed to see him go.
Now, Sehwag aside, there is one Indian player who I think has been actually very impressive, and that is Praveen Kumar, whose batting exploits we all enjoyed yesterday when India were on their way to that crushing defeat.
Well, we were so nearly talking about the quickest Test 50,
weren't we? I mean, he would have got, if he hadn't got out, he would surely have got there easily. I mean, he had another 10 balls or so to score the last 10 runs, and he'd still been within the run rate. But I think he has bowled very, very well. There are a few questions after Lords, which I raised, and I wasn't the only one, about whether he was just a sort of military medium. He needed the pitch and the overhead conditions to suit him in order to actually give the batsman any trouble. But he has consistently shown the kind of application that has been very much lacking from the rest of the Indian attack, I think.
And he's rather refreshingly just shown a real appetite for the occasion, which a lot of the Indians haven't. He's been smiling, he's been beaming.
And not only has he been smiling, but he's got really, really angry at times. He's been quite nice, because sometimes it's actually really annoying when you see Tendulkar kind of smiling in the outfit, and he's a happy-go-lucky kind of chap. But
I think the other thing is with Kumar, you feel like when Zaheer comes back, that is a partnership that India can get excited about. I mean, I think if Kumar's sort of the new guy on the block who's impressed, I think Dravid's reputation, he's maybe the only one of the Indian batsmen who will leave this series with his reputation enhanced. For my money, he's never really given his wicket away in this series. He's been dismissed by a couple of outstanding deliveries, but he's never really given his wicket away. And he's just had that kind of classical defiance that's really characterised his career. I mean, some of his innings have kind of made me think a little bit of Chanderpaul, often having to bat defiantly when the rest of your teammates just don't appear to care.
It's quite interesting to compare the rest of that Indian lineup
to the West Indies lineup, but fair in these circumstances. So if those are kind of India's highlights, I mean, from an English perspective, you're now the world number one. You've won the series in a fashion that no one could have envisaged. If you're Andrew Strauss or Andy Flower, where do you look for improvement?
That's an interesting question, and it seems sort of a bit blasphemous to be asking this at this stage. We should still be on the champagne. I was lucky enough to be at the last day of the Trent Bridge match, watching England bosh a few and then bowl out the Indians cheaply. And the one thing that I was slightly disappointed by, and it was something that reared its head at Edgbaston again yesterday, was some of Andrew Strauss's fields setting overly defensive fields when he clearly had India on the rack. At Trent Bridge, when England were defending 400-odd, and Tendulkar was batting. It's the only time I've ever seen Tendulkar bat live. He was batting serenely. Everyone around him was crumbling, and he just looked, nothing was troubling him. He was hitting some beautiful straight drives. And Strauss's reaction very, very quickly, even though wickets were falling at the other end, so by default the pressure was necessarily on Tendulkar. When Tendulkar was on strike, he was putting sweepers back on both the off and on sides. He was taking slips out and putting them into extra cover, for instance. And I just thought that, you know, that maybe he needed at times to really ram the advantage home, really be extra aggressive at times like that. And it's the kind of attitude that you saw with the Australian side of the early 2000s, is that they never took their foot off the opponent's throat.
Strauss, in a way, is almost having to adapt to that position of dominance. Yeah. He's finding himself in positions that he's not maybe used to as a captain. I mean, for me, I'm not convinced that Owen Morgan is the long-term solution at number six. There seems to have been a consensus that his 100 at Edgbaston has kind of settled the matter.
Dropped twice on the way.
Dropped twice, and we're not talking sort of half chances. I mean, he was dropped by Sri Sant and Dravid, both chances that you know, 9 and 10 times should be taken at test level. He was extremely lucky.
Particularly the Dravid chance.
Oh, the Dravid chance. And he just never looked, for me, we all know how well he moves his feet towards the spinners, but he never looked that comfortable against the seamers. And I can't help feeling that you look at England's top five, and there is a drop-off when you get to Morgan. There is a sort of drop in ability. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether England will settle with him or will gamble. I mean, Bapara...
I felt very, very sorry for him.
I think that's the consensus on Bapara. Everyone feels sorry for him.
There wasn't much that he can do. I mean, yes, he looked. I mean, he had a very streaky four and didn't look... And actually ended up playing a defensive shot to get out, which wasn't a nice thing.
Yeah, it was very... I mean, it was sad. And, you know, I think he deserves another chance. But we've been talking about, you know, James Taylor, wonderful young talent. I mean, when will he get his chance? Mm. I mean, finally, with this England-India series, I mean, are England truly the world number one? I mean, can we believe the test rankings?
Well, what's interesting is that no side has gone to number one recently with a really good fight. India went to number one because Australia was slipping off. England are going to number one because India is slipping off.
Have had a general nightmare.
So it's sort of difficult to say. And I think the rankings in themselves, obviously, they mean something. But I don't think they mean everything. And I think what England need to do is, in order to truly be the number one side, they need to stay there. That's a sign of a dominant side.
Right. There's been a sense that I think this Australian team has slipped. But no one has... I mean, they've slipped pretty definitively, but there's no one who's really quite assumed the throne yet. I mean, I think there are two main challenges for this England team to really confirm it. They've got to go and prove that they can play in the subcontinent. It won't be an easy winter. I mean, Pakistan and Sri Lanka both have their limitations, I think, but it won't be an easy winter. And then I think, actually, it's next summer when South Africa visits that we may have a really true playoff for world number one. Yeah. I mean, Steyn and Morkel will fancy these conditions in a way that perhaps the Indian bowlers didn't.
So we've had a tussle at the top of
the game, yeah.
England against India. There's also been a tussle going on recently at the very bottom of the table between Bangladesh and Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, who of course weren't part of the table for many years, they've recently rejoined the test arena. There have been a test and some...
A couple of one days.
A couple of one days that are still going on. Just as the England-India series has been a little bit of a disappointment for being so one-sided, the Bangladesh-Zimbabwe test was a bit disappointing, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I actually think at a time when that England-India series was really failing to live up to expectations, I don't think this was a bad test match, actually. I mean, I think it kind of went back and forth... I think it was, you know, I think it was probably to everyone's surprise how well the Zimbabweans looked, you know, they sort of adapted to being back in the test game. But I think they, you know, it was quite a close series. It was quite a well, series, it was only one test. It was quite a well-contested test match in that, consistently, when one side got on top, the other side fell back. There was a lack of real, real talent
on display. It felt like a kind of a basement battle. But it was none the worse for it. There was a lot of tenacity. Bangladesh, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Zimbabwe have just come back into test cricket. They will be cock-a-hoop that they've won their first test back. Bangladesh, meanwhile, must be utterly despondent about
that. Well, you do have to ask the question, I mean, where do they go from that? I mean, I was slightly astonished to discover that's their 69th test match. Mm. We can't keep referring to them as new boys, as inexperienced, and it's becoming harder and harder to point to any evidence of improvement. The way their batsmen threw wickets away... They actually looked a long way behind the Zimbabweans. And let's remember, were full of very inexperienced players themselves.
And in a sense, you can sympathise with, I'm not sure sympathise is the right word, but India's attitude towards Bangladesh, which is that their kind of no hope is a bit of a waste of time as a test site. You can kind of see where they're coming from then.
Well, I think it's going to lead to a very serious think about where do they go next? I mean, can you keep asking the top test nations to keep playing them? When they're this poor. And but also, how can Bangladesh improve? I mean, do we force them now to go back to maybe playing its weaker sides? I'm not actually sure what the solution...
And even though Zimbabwe will rightly so be celebrating after this victory, I think the sort of plight of Bangladesh should be a warning to them that time at the top table doesn't necessarily translate to success in the game, and that actually some of the big questions about Zimbabwean cricket. For instance, I mean, Robert Mugabe is still the president of the Zimbabwean cricket board.
Yeah.
Their sort of county, well, it's obviously not a county setup, but their internal domestic
setup. There are some very serious financial issues
still has a lot of questions going on. So whilst this is definitely a sort of reason for hope for the Zimbabweans, I don't think that...
I think there was some real excitement, actually, about their side. I mean, I think Hamilton Mazakadze, Brendan Taylor, both making hundreds, and they showed a determination that the Bangladeshi batsmen, far more experienced, just completely lagged. They both batted for a long time for their hundreds. They weren't quick scores. And then these two young seamers, Brian Vittori and Carl Jarvis, they've got only 28 first-class games between them. Both bowled extremely well, carried far more threat than the Bangladeshi side. It'd be very interesting to see where Zimbabwe go next. I mean, will the Test nations be any more willing to give them competitive games? From the archives, and in the week where Zimbabwe returned to the Test arena, we're going to go back to 1992, where they first entered the Test arena. We're in Harare, and the visitors are India.
But Zimbabwean cricket started some 102 years before that. Don't worry, this isn't going to take long.
this is going to be a minute
August 1890, the first Zimbabwean cricket match took place. And then by the mid-1890s, there were regular matches being played there. Interestingly, Zimbabwe have always, in a sense, been in some kind of international isolation, even when they were in the form of Rhodesia. In the first half of the 20th century, there were occasional visits from touring sides who were in the region. The MCC went there a few times. But the majority of their cricket actually came from competing in the Currie Cup, the South African domestic competition, which began in 1904. Their greatest moment of triumph came in the 1931-2 competition, which they nearly won, but there was a ludicrous point system, which meant that you got the same number of points if you won the match than if you got a lead in the first innings and then drew it. So basically all you had to do was get a lead in the first innings and then bat for hours.
So you're suggesting that their greatest moment of triumph came when they nearly won the tournament?
Well, this is Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Moving on. The other way that Zimbabwean players came to recognition was actually by representing South Africa at an international level, and there were several people who did that. The most famous is the legendary Colin Bland, who had a test batting average of 49 and a reputation for superb fielding that perhaps continues today. I think it's one of the hallmarks of the Zimbabwean side that they can't bowl, but probably can field.
Well, I think that's both a little bit harsh, but yeah, they do tend to be, there does tend to be a high standard of fielding.
Historically, the best Zimbabwean side was probably actually in the 1970s when the great South African all-rounder Mike Proctor played for them. Duncan Fletcher, obviously very much
course,
in the news at the moment, was playing. Brian Davison and the Surrey and England pace bowler Robin Jackman. The problem was that South Africa were at their strongest too, and so Zimbabwe never won the Currie Cup, and they weren't competing internationally then. They had a strong case then to come into international cricket, but the Declaration of Independence in 1965 and the subsequent international sanctions made international cricket impossible, and that's when we first see sort of the political side of things coming in and impeding cricket.
It's interesting
cricket
how
in
many
Zimbabwe.
Parallels there are in that you've got this sort of the cricket team's ready. But the political side. So also interesting that they had to kind of develop for many years in domestic cricket, because we've been talking about how Bangladesh don't appear to be going anywhere as a test nation. Interesting that Zimbabwe really grew up through being forced to play years and years in South Africa's domestic league.
Exactly. And it was only in 1980 when independence came that there was a really new era in Zimbabwean cricket. In 1981, they were an associate member of the ICC, and in 1983, they participated in the World Cup for the first time, when, of course, they beat Australia in their first match. They were consistently weakened, though, by a lot of their best players emigrating. Graham Hick is a good example of defecting to England. Between 1983 and 1992, they played in three World Cups, and they were made to qualify for each one of them by competing among the other minnows, as the system was then. But they covered themselves with distinction. They never lost a qualifying match. So this was, you know, this was indisputably a strong setup that they had. They knew, though, that without Test cricket, they would never really be a proper international side.
I mean, it's hard to persuade players. We talk about the issue of players emigrating, but I mean, it's hard to persuade players to stay unless you can offer them Test cricket.
Exactly. And the Zimbabwean Cricket Union realised that this was really the one thing that they really needed to nail before they could be a proper cricketing nation. And finally, they succeeded. In 1992, they were elevated to Test status. And then along came their first match.
And we find ourselves in Harare. India are the visitors, and Zimbabwe win the toss, and they choose to bat. It's not a difficult decision. It's a very lifeless pitch at the Harare Sports Club, and the weather is sweltering. We're talking in mid-30 degrees here. And India's bowlers, they've had very little match practice. I mean, you can imagine the way they approach this test match, you know, a new test with the Minnows. They weren't probably taking this too seriously. And also, Harare, like a couple of actually African capital cities, at an extremely high altitude, which is something that actually people find very unnerving when they turn up there and can do quite odd things. So the bowlers had lots of problems.
And in fact, India bowls at six bowlers in the first innings,
to keep things together, I think.
And then seven in the second innings.
And Zimbabwe make a very solid start. Kevin Arnott and a young Grant Flowers sort of lay a very solid foundation. They put on 100 for the first wicket. When Arnott's dismissed, he's made 40 off 176 balls, which is a bit of a clue of what's going to come here. You know, that's scoring at less than a rate of, what's the strike rate of about 22, I think. Yeah, we're talking slow. And Alistair Campbell, then now the chair of selectors, comes in, and he and Flowers.
Not to be confused with any other English politician.
No, that really would be interesting. But no, he and Flower lead Zimbabwe to 175 for one. I mean, this is very good for a new sort of test nation. But then both fall in quick succession towards the end of the first day. The Zimbabweans lose two further wickets the next morning, and they're 252 for five, and suddenly India have got a hope here of maybe bringing this innings to a close and getting into bat. But at this point, the captain, David Houghton, who's 35, he's making his test debut at 35, and Andy Flower, who, you know, of course, went on to become probably the great Zimbabwean batsman, and of course now shining as a coach. The two of them are at the crease.
And Andy Flower keeping in this match as well.
Ah, interesting. They build a painstaking 165 run partnership. It's very slow start. Houghton rather appropriately becomes his country's first test centurion. His 121 coming off 322 balls. Flower's 59 takes 201. So again, showing plenty of application. When they fell, the tail folds promptly, and Zimbabwe finish on 4-5-6 all out. It's by a distance the highest score that any nation has made on Test debut.
And it's interesting when you look at the Indian bowling lineup. Kapil Dev, Srinath and Anil Kumble are the people who jump out at you. Ravi Shastri sending down 17 overs as well.
you're kind of thinking it should be a bowling attack that's able to get through this line.
Absolutely.
The slow rate of scoring means that this 4-5-6 have taken 2.5 days. So it's pretty clear at this stage Zimbabwe won't be beaten. Things don't start well for them, though, in the field. Edo Brandes, who's their one genuinely quick bowler, pulls up injured after just two overs, plays no further part. But they keep going. Shastri and Rahman fall to the medium pace of Crocker and Burmester. And then John Traycos, who's really sort of the star, I think, in a way, of this first test. He enters the fray. It's 22 years after he played a test for South Africa, and he's back. He's now 45 years of age, and he promptly dismisses Tendulkar for a duck. Not a bad way to come back. He then gets Azhruddin, again, not a bad name to add to the CV, and Raja. And suddenly, India are 101
And Kapil Dev as well, you know, you might as well.
And he picks up Dev later on. So, I mean, it's quite a wonderful story, that. He was 23 when he last played for South Africa. He's now a 45-year-old playing for Zimbabwe.
It's one of these stories where you just think it's a bunch of fairly unlikely. I mean, we've said how Zimbabwe cricket was quite strong at the time, but you think that they're an unlikely bunch to be really testing India. But both with the bat and with the ball,
they're putting them under real pressure. I mean, at this stage, India still need 156 just to avoid the follow-on. I mean, Kapil Dev attacks in truly sort of agricultural style, makes 60 off 85 balls. But it's really Mandrake's patient century that ensures disasters averted. It's slow, in keeping with the character of this match, 104 coming off 422 balls. But it does ensure that India avoid the follow-on and get to 307. Zimbabwe...
Which comes off 170 overs.
Mm. We hear, according to Wisden, there was a very small crowd in for this game, and perhaps we can understand why. Zimbabwe have a 149-run lead, but with less than a day's play remaining, they've really got no opportunity to do anything with it. And they sort of meander to 146 for four at the close. I mean, I think it's a very admirable debut for a new nation. I mean, your very thorough introduction showed us how they really had to learn the ropes outside the Test arena, and they were clearly ready for Test status.
Yep.
And they've acquitted themselves sort of extremely well.
And what's interesting here, actually, is how we've seen with the Bangladeshi side, one of the marks of sort of new or inexperienced Test nations at the moment, and you see it, for instance, also with bad county sides in the four-day game, is a simple inability to bat for long periods. But what you see with the Zimbabwe side is a complete ability to bat for long periods, possibly to bat for too long periods in a way. But this is one of the things that made them such a hopeful side in their early days, the fact that they could compile 456 against quite a good Indian side.
And they showed that commitment. I suppose the big transformation, you'd say, between this Zimbabwean side in 1992 and the Zimbabwean side we've got returning to the Test arena now in 2011, is there's a lot more black Zimbabwean cricketers now. And I think it's one thing you can really commend Zimbabwean cricket on, that in a way South Africa has perhaps really struggled at times often to... I suppose you'd say to diversify the game, to diversify. And it's
South Africa seems to have been obliged by quotas, whereas, in fact, there's quite an interesting article in this week's Wisden Cricketer. Is it the Wisden Cricketer has rebranded itself?
Is it the Cricketer? I think it's the Cricketer.
The Cricketer sponsored by Wisden or the Cricket of Wisden or something. Whatever it is, there's quite an interesting article in it about Zimbabwe this month, and which basically talks about the way that there has become a kind of very natural progression for a lot of young black cricketers, which is an encouraging thing.
And I think it's something Zimbabwe should be very proud of at a time when the country's had so much else to deal with.
So, to the book review, and over the last couple of weeks, we have both been enjoying tremendously Penguins Stop Play, 11 Village Cricketers Take on the World by Harry Thompson. Harry Thompson, being a BBC, having worked for the BBC in various capacities, works on...
He wrote, a lot of script for, various quiz shows, various comedy radio shows.
Absolutely, and one of the defining features of this book is simply how well written it is, and it's one of the things that's going to make it so difficult for us to review and convince you of its worth, simply because the best way to convince you of its worth would just be to sit here and read out whole chapters, because it is side-splittingly funny and at the end, as we will come on to, tear-jerkingly sad as well. Harry Thompson, when he's at Oxford, is rejected from the Worcester College side.
Grays-nose.
No, Worcester. It is Worcester.
Is it Worcester? I apologise. Apologies.
No, I was wrong. I thought it was Brazenays, but it's Worcester. He's rejected from the side, and he decides with a few of his friends to set up a rather more informal club, the Captain Scott Invitational 11.
Brilliant. He puts an advert in the student paper basically saying, if you've never played cricket before,
if you're rubbish
come, and
cricket,
play for my
come, team. Come and play. And he forms a side, and they go off, and they play in Oxford quite a lot, and when they all graduate, they play various games, and they go abroad a bit. And then finally, they decide that they are going to go around the world, and they're going to become the first team to have played a game on every continent. And this is the substance of the book. One of its defining features is precisely that it combines a view of cricket that sort of you and I know so well, the absolutely crap village side, who play it for fun. But it combines that with a real kind of humour. I mean, some of the anecdotes are just
Well,
fantastic.
I think for an awful lot of people reading this book who play at village level, there are so many wonderful moments of recognition. A bit that we both loved was Thompson's very almost scientific description of the different stages that a cricket girlfriend goes through. The idea that initially she rather loves the idea of her dashing hero going out in cricketing whites, and by the end of it, he talks about how it, you know, it gets to a question of it's you or the me or the cricket. And then there's also this wonderful sort of references to the various dodgy tricks that captains will play. So he talks about how certain captains, when they're put into bat and don't really fancy facing a new ball, will sort of come up with the old excuse of, "Oh God, you know, I left the new ball in my wife's car,"
and then pull out some battered old soft that's been in the next for several months. The other one, which I think we both identify with, is this this trick. I mean, I've been suckered by it several times of teams which bring along sort of 12-year-old boys. And you're told, you're sort of looked at disapprovingly, as if you're being very, very unsporting if you play against them properly in any way. But as batsmen, they are usually the most technically correct and ferocious players you've ever played against. But as bowlers, most terrifyingly, I usually bat up the order for my club, and occasionally you get a kind of 12-year-old. So you think, I don't need a helmet, they're only about 6 inches tall, that's fine. And the first ball whistles past your nose, and you think, well, I mean, come on, how is this fair anyway? And as soon as you score, and he runs off everyone, tuts, and says, oh, you're demoralising.
And Thompson does talk about how basically you can't win. If you bowl badly and sort of gently to a lot of these talented young cricketers, you get smashed around. And then if you bowl well, you meet sort of widespread condemnation. I mean, I suppose it is a celebration, really, this book, of amateurism, which I think we've talked about before in this podcast. This sort of, it's a very kind of, I suppose it's quite an English ideal, it's quite a cricketing ideal, this idea that sort of, you know, you play cricket in the right spirit, you play it for the fun of it, and you kind of enjoy it. And there's something quite exciting about the fact that you've got a team that's brought together of players who, in a lot of cases, have never played the game. And I find it quite sort of enjoyable how, through application, they improve. I mean, Harry Thompson memorably describes his first season where every ball he hit went straight, you know, vertically up. He scored one run all season, and by the end, he's scoring 50.
But then again, when they decide to do this round the world tour playing a game on every continent, he decides that he wants to go around the world in 80 runs on that riff on a Jules Verne theme. And I think he ends up going around the world in 8 runs, such as it. But it comes up again. There are some amusing scenarios. They're in South Africa, but he's insisted when he's fixed the matches that they are a village side and they do not want to play any proper opposition. They're playing this game in South Africa and they turn up at this rather nice looking ground. And and he says, look, I just want to tell you that, you know, we are a properly awful side, we're a village side. And they go, oh, it's fine, two of our sort of goodish players are actually injured and can't play today. And he said, oh, who are they? And they're sort of A.B. de Villiers and someone else.
The travels do throw up some fantastic anecdotes. I mean, my personal favourite, they go to Hong Kong. It has taken Harry Thompson hours of pain and organisation, thousands of pounds to organise this tour. They're in Hong Kong. Very early in his innings, he gets struck on the pad, and his friend Terence, without any concern, instantly the finger goes up. You get hit on the pad, wherever you are on the crease, you're out. And you think, God, you know, however many thousands of miles later. I mean, the book does also capture the fact that cricket teams, well, I suppose any sports teams, really, but, you know, a cricket team does bring together selections of people who, without the sport, would actually never really meet. I mean, it's an incredible collection. You have sort of, you've got sort of wealthy bankers to sort of recent immigrants who just love the sport.
You've got the likes of Hugh Grant and Ian Hislop.
There is some quite interesting celebrity. I mean, the Ian Hislop anecdote of him actually batting and then with a London cab waiting on the boundary, me to run and take him away, it's kind of sad in a way. It does sort of show how, like, fame's taken over and, you know, there's no time for cricket anymore.
There's a strong parallel here, I think, with the J.M. Barrie book, Peter Pan's First 11, that we reviewed a few months ago, which is a very similar setup, a kind of a group of quite bizarre people, being idiosyncratic people being brought together and playing cricket together. Where I think Harry Thompson's book, Penguin Stop Play, benefits so much is that it's a first-person narrative, and you can really sort of feel the enthusiasm he has for the whole thing. I mean, when they go around the world, he basically spends his entire life savings on paying for other people to come.
It's strange as well that he doesn't seem to notice how much of an obsession it's become. I mean, as you say, he talks about how he's got £10,000 of savings and he spends the lot on both himself and some other players.
And that really comes through, I suppose, with the ending, which I think brought a tear to...
We both cried. Both we both a bit crying during this ending.
So you go through this entire book really sort of, in a sense, falling in love with this side and with what they get up to and the beautiful writing. And then at the end you discover that actually this book has been written after Harry Thompson has found out that he's got cancer, which he dies from, I think, 5 days after he sends
completes
the final
yeah.
proofs off to his editor. Sorry if we spoiled the ending for anyone. But I think the real point of it is that it just it makes the whole thing so poignant. And so often with these kind of books, it just feels a bit kind of wearied and a bit sort of, I don't know, there's something sort of a bit sort of thigh-slapping chumminess about it. But with this, it's so genuinely felt, and it's just so well written and so deeply meant.
And he seems to realise by the end as well that this is, cricket's just not being a hobby anymore. I mean, it's a huge part of his life, really. He seems to remember that at the end. From the blogs, and this week we're descending to the Southern Hemisphere to look at our first ever Australian blog.
Descending.
Descending.
That's an entirely geographical world.
Yeah, I'll rephrase it. We're heading south.
Right.
We're looking at Thoughts from the Dustbin, an Australian blog. And, I mean, one of the things I guess that's exciting about the blogosphere, and maybe one of the things that it offers that the more conventional websites don't, is the fact that you do get these very clear sort of national perspectives. You get a very clear view of sort of, well, I guess what the Australian consensus is at the moment. It's interesting just kind of how much flat Cricket Australia comes in for across the blog, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're used to having the ECB being slated on every decision it makes. And it's quite nice to see Andrew Hilditch being hung from every lamppost in the
I mean, coming in for some sort of very heavy criticism. I mean, it's interesting, particularly this kind of attitude to the selection policy, this kind of feeling that his unwillingness to stick with any of the spinners, to kind of support them, to kind of back them up. I suppose we look at a lot of different blogs, and I mean, some of them go for the strategy of long, kind of very thought through pieces on a particular point. This blog trades, I guess, in strong opinions, and I think it works in the sense that you kind of you get a very clear feeling of, I guess, what a lot of Aussie fans.
Yep.
Feeling about the site.
It's quite a nice, and it's quite nicely illustrated. Actually, I rather enjoyed one of the main tabs, which is the never-ending spin cycle, which is just a list of the ten spinners who have played for Australia since Shane Warne retired in 2007. And it's just little sort of touches like that, which it kind of hit home quite hard.
And the posts do tend to vary quite a bit in format. So the dropping of Steve Smith, rather than being discussed in sort of a traditional post, we get we presume it's a fake email from Andrew Hilditch
but
to Steve
never know,
Smith.
But you never
we never know. In which Hilditch decides that actually we're bored with your chubby, freckly little mug, which frankly does seem about as intellectual.
About the level of Australian selection.
I mean, also, I think we kind of get quite a strong sense of how a lot of Australians don't feel like there's been a response to the Ashes defeat. I mean, there's a rather interesting post titled England Win the 2031 Ashes Series, based a lot around the dropping of Simon Cattich, actually. This feeling that players who are really strong test players are just being ignored and just kind of being left behind.
And actually, it's interesting because the Sri Lanka-Australia series coming up, which we'll be reviewing in the next podcast, is really going to be a time when all the talking is put to one side, whether that's on the blogs or whether that's Andrew Hilditch over the airwaves. All the talking is going to be put to one side, and we're going to see some results. But it's quite nice to see in Thoughts from the Dustbin some of the background things going on.
So yeah, if you're curious to know what cricket looks like from an Australian point of view, thoughtsfromthedustbin.com. ¶¶
So, on to the debate. Recently, we've been having a lot of talk about what has been the best Test match of all time to mark the anniversary of the 2000s Test match, which was, of course, the England-India match at Lords, which England won so convincingly. Here at Rustwap Radio, we're proud to be different, and we've decided to have a debate about what was the worst Test ever.
And it was interesting when they did this on TMS, when they were talking about the best Test match. You had, I think it was Jeff Boycott, you had Steve Waugh, you had Jonathan Agnew talking a lot about, you know, what is it that makes a good Test? I mean, what is it that makes a truly bad, horrific, unwatchable Test match?
For me, it's essentially one-sidedness. Because one of the great things about Test matches is that there are so many little games within games and little subplots going on.
Right, and the ebb and flow, one side on top, one side on bottom.
Exactly. And so when I first started thinking about this, for one-sidedness, I immediately went back to the 1950s, which was a time when a lot of Test cricket was quite one-sided. There was a great match in 1958, for instance, when England beat New Zealand by an innings and 148 runs, having posted at 269 in their first innings. So England scored 269 and still won by an innings and 148.
So the New Zealand innings were kind of blink and you miss it, sort of.
Yep, exactly. In 1960, there was a quite different side, kind of one-sidedness, when there was basically just never-ending batting. England's 482 was replied to by the Windies' 563, and both sides scored at under three and over. There was never the prospect of a result, and cricket around then was dominated by the idea that you just batted for as long as you could to ensure that you couldn't lose, and then you drew. And so you just saw batting with no equal contest between batting.
And I suppose if we're talking about how one-sidedness makes a game bad, the other thing that makes a game bad is sheer defensiveness. And yeah, I think Test cricket has over the years thrown up those tests where neither side really wants to win the game, bizarrely enough.
Which is why there's a difference between Alistair Cook scoring his 294 at the rate he did, in the cause that he did. I mean, if he had done that in a second innings in order to score out, in order to draw a game, that would have been one thing. But the fact that he did it in a winning cause and the context of the match was right, was, I think, a good thing. I mean, what do you think makes for a
I suppose the other thing is, once you take away, you know, there's this issue of how do the two sides match up. So we've looked at one-sidedness, and we've also looked at this sort of desire not to win the game. I suppose the simple thing is quality of cricket, isn't it? So we've got this idea of how we expect Test cricket to be the pinnacle, and it kind of, when it falls short of that, we're all disappointed. I mean, I, in my choice, kept things a little bit more contemporary, just because I was trying to think of what was the Test match that really I hated. Yeah. And this Test match is notable for the fact, for me at any rate, this is the only Test match I can remember in recent times that I, as an England fan, stopped following. I just couldn't bear it. We're in 2008 and we're in the West Indies. We're actually in 2009, March 2009. It's the fourth Test of that series that England went on to lose 1-0. England rack up 600 on an utterly dead Bridgetown pitch. Everyone helps themselves. And then the West Indies, who were kind of used to collapsing, then respond by making 750. You know, there's, from kind of 2 days into this game, there's never really any prospect, any serious prospect of a result. And the batting just went on and on. And perhaps what really made this, in my opinion, the worst Test match I've experienced, was the pitch. We had a dead track that simply stopped the bowlers competing with the batsmen. And it was horrible stuff. And the fact that if you get a Test match where you get to day three, day four, and you know that you're effectively killing time, I mean, it's verging on unwatchable.
It is. There was a game that my worst ever game was a little bit further back. It was back in 2001. I do vaguely remember watching it. Back in 2001, it was Sri Lanka England. Sri Lanka bat first and compiled 470 for five at slower than three and over. Marvin Athapattu scores 201 off 536 balls. I mean, this is attritional cricket. It is. Best, worst, I didn't know whether attritional
was certainly most attritional.
At his most attritional. So Sri Lanka score 475, England never get into the game. They score 252, which comes at under two and over. They're asked to follow on, and they score 171 at an even slower rate. And so this is a great example of Sri Lanka being ruthlessly effective in the game, but just utterly dull in their style of cricket. I mean, it's not helped by the fact that after the match, several of the Sri Lankan players are fined, and I think one of them is even banned for excessive appealing. But it's just this kind of idea of win at all costs, which you see in going back to the 50s as well, which just makes for completely unengaging cricket.
And I suppose it's another factor, this idea that we expect the game to be played in a certain way, in a certain spirit. Well, we can but hope that, you know, we don't have any more contenders for this
within the next
title.
2000
in the next 2000 tests. Thank you for joining us again. There'll be probably a 3-week break until we join you again. I hope to be compiling an in-depth report on cricket in Cuba. When we do return in early September, we'll be thinking about how this England-India series finally finished and looking at how things are going in Sri Lanka. Join us then.